Today's class is about Muhammad. Our first question in having an entire class devoted to Muhammad is, why study about Muhammad? Well, I've listed some statistics there on the handout. Islam is the fastest growing religion in Europe. The number of Muslims on the European continent has tripled in the last 30 years, and it's going to do nothing but increase. According to one organization, as of 2007, the fastest growing religion of the world is Islam. And they point to high birth rates and immigration for the reasons. CNN says that Islam is the second largest religion in the world after Christianity. Islam is also the fastest growing religion. In the United States, for example, nearly 80% of the more than 1,200 mosques have been built in the past 12 years. And then the next statistic says there are 3,000 mosques, so I'm not sure about the timing of that. But there are a lot of mosques in this country, and it is a very fast-growing religion here. And as that fourth statistic notes, it's on the verge of surpassing Judaism as the largest non-Christian faith in this country. There are a lot of Muslims in this country, a lot in the world. So why study about Muhammad? Well, the simple fact is that God has commanded us to take the gospel to the entire world, and one-fourth of that world follows Muhammad. So how can we ignore Muhammad? We have to know about him. We're supposed to take the gospel to the entire world. We need to know what we're facing. So who was Muhammad? Well, the religion of Islam is centered upon the person of Muhammad. You cannot fully understand either Islam or the Quran without considering the life and the history of this person named Muhammad. To the Muslim mind, Muhammad is the most important person in all of human history. Although the Muslims do not believe that Muhammad was divine or that he is to be worshipped, they do not believe that. They do believe that he was the ultimate example and model of human experience, an example that should be followed. Now, we have four primary sources for the historical study of Muhammad. If we're going to study about his life, there are four ancient sources that we can turn to. The Quran itself is one of those four sources. It says a lot about Muhammad. The other three are all biographies of Muhammad, one written in 773 AD, one in 825, and one in 932. And those four sources taken together really tell us all that we have to know about Muhammad. Those three biographies serve as the basis for something called the Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H. That's a collection of stories and reports and oral traditions about Muhammad. They all come from those three biographies. Now, at the outset of our study today, we should note something very important. Everything we know about Muhammad comes from a Muslim source, an Islam source. Islamic source. That's what we know. It all comes from a source connected with Islam or the Muslim beliefs. We're totally dependent upon them for what we know about Muhammad. But that cuts both ways, because some of the things we're going to look at about Muhammad today are hardly flattering, and yet they come from those same Muslim sources, the same Islamic sources that we get the other material from. No one of that time was antagonistic to Muhammad, making up stuff about him. All we have about him comes from Islamic sources. The traditional date and place of Muhammad's birth is AD 570 in Mecca, which is a city in western Saudi Arabia near the coast of the Red Sea. The inhabitants of Arabia at that time were all fragmented into tribes. And Muhammad was born into one of those tribes. And in fact, the tribe that he was born into had an interesting history. It was the guardian of the Kaaba, K-A-B-A-H, which is this cube-shaped building in Mecca that they believe was built by Abraham and Ishmael. So his tribe was in charge of that, and he was born into that. Before he was born, his father died while on a trading trip. His mother, Amina, then died when he was six. At that time, he was given to his grandfather, who the historians tell us treated him with very special favor and affection. But the grandfather died when he was eight. So before he was born, his father died. His mother died when he was 6. He goes to live with his grandfather. His grandfather died when he was 8. And at that time, his care passed to an uncle, his paternal uncle, who also treated him with great affection. And his aunt, Fatima, in fact, treated him with such affection that it's said that she treated him with more affection than she did even her own children. From the age of 9 on, he accompanied that uncle on trading trips into Syria and even beyond. And it's on those excursions that he came in contact with Jewish and Christian sources. And in fact, there's a lot of Jewish and Christian influence in the Quran, as we'll see as we move through this. And he started having that kind of influence very early in his life as he went on those trading trips. While growing up, he would spend long periods of time out in the desert tending sheep alone. He was also being trained in weaponry and warfare as part of that tribe that went on those trading trips. By the time he was 20, he developed a reputation, we are told, for such honesty that he was called El Amin, which means reliable or trustworthy. And that reputation brought him to the attention of a very wealthy widow named Khadija, a wealthy widow in Mecca. And she asked Muhammad to supervise one of her trading trips to Syria. She was 15 years older than he was, and she had been twice married, although now she was a widow. She offered herself to him in marriage, and he accepted. The year was 595, and Muhammad was 25 years old. Although later, Muhammad had multiple marriages. In fact, when he died, he left 9 widows. But he did not marry anyone else until after this woman, Khadija, had died when he was 50 years old. They had 6 children together, only one of which, Fatima, named after his aunt, survived to give him any descendants. For the next 15 years, 595 to 610, it's called the silent period. We really have no record of his life, but we can presume, for most of that we have no record of his life, and we can presume that he was actively involved in this trading enterprise that his wife owned. But he also spent time in religious and contemplative meditation, we are told. And for 1 month each year, he would go to a cave in Mount Hira, a few miles north of Mecca, and have this contemplative meditation. In fact, he would do that each month in the month of Ramadan, which is the month of heat. When it was very hot outside, he would go and live in this cave. And it was at that location, at the age of 40, that we are told he had his first religious vision, his first revelation. And we're told that the messenger of Allah who brought that to him was the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel, we are told, also said that he would be bringing additional messages for the next 23 years. Now, the utterances received by Muhammad, supposedly in these revelations, were put down in Al-Quran, which means the recitation or the reading. And that, of course, became the Quran that we've all heard about. Now, the first of these revelations left Muhammad in a state of fear and despair, we are told. In fact, his wife had to reassure him that he was not under the influence of a demon. In fact, she went to go see her cousin, an old man who had become a Christian, we are told, and who believed that a great prophet was coming to turn the Arabs away from polytheism. So Muhammad's wife, after he has the first vision, goes to see her cousin. He, we are told, is a Christian who is awaiting a great prophet. Surprise, surprise, he tells his cousin, Muhammad's wife, Muhammad is the one. He's the one we've been waiting for. So she rushes back and tells Muhammad. Muhammad then spends the next 3 years preaching, but just to his family and friends. His wife was his first convert. His 4 uncles, though, showed no inclination at all to follow him. At the end of those 3 years, Muhammad gets another vision. And this vision tells him to arise and warn. And at that time, he begins to preach publicly in Mecca. And he begins to face some persecution from the local religious leaders. In 619, Muhammad's wife died. And shortly thereafter, that protectorate uncle that he had been depending on also died. And another uncle replaced him as leader of that family, and this other uncle was very hostile to Muhammad. So things were starting to look kind of bad for him. Facing persecution, things were not good at home, his wife had died. The next major event at this point involved a purported trip to heaven by Muhammad. One night, we are told, he was awakened by the angel Gabriel, who showed him a heavenly white steed with wings. And this steed took him to Jerusalem, where he met with Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. And he was then taken into heaven itself, we are told. It is this event that led to the construction of the Dome of the Rock Mosque in Jerusalem, which was also, of course, on the site where the Jewish temple once stood, and which is, I guess, the most hotly contested site in all the world today, is the top of that mountain where you have the Dome of the Rock Mosque and the site of the ancient temple. All of that came about because of this supposed vision by Muhammad that he was taken there and saw Moses and Jesus and Abraham. And that is referred to as the third most holy site in Islam. Now, Muhammad had two more dreams the following year. And in these dreams, he was instructed to marry the six-year-old daughter of his best friend. Keeping in mind, this is the example that we're all to follow, according to them. Now, while that marriage to the six-year-old was being put into effect, he met and married a 30-year-old widow. But he continued in his plans to marry the six-year-old, which he did. And the marriage, and again, this is coming from Muslim sources. This is not someone who's antagonistic to Muhammad writing this down. These are his friends telling us about this. The marriage to the six-year-old was consummated when she was 9, and he was in his early 50s. Now, fast forward a few thousand years, or I guess less than that, about 1,500 years, and we have the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, apparently following his great leader, the Prophet, who the Ayatollah himself married a 10-year-old when he was 28. So we have Muhammad married to a 6-year-old, now marrying another woman, that's 2. We need to keep track of the number of marriages because that's going to become important here in just a moment. In the year 620, it's an important year, 6 men from a tribe 200 miles north of Mecca, met Muhammad and became convinced that he was a prophet. Those 6 converts went home and made additional converts. Muhammad and his followers in Mecca made plans to move to this other tribe to avoid the persecution at home, which they did after Muhammad miraculously escaped an assassination plot. Now, his escape from that assassination plot in 622 is called the Hijra, or the flight. And it's so important to Muslims that it serves as the starting point for the Islamic calendar. You'll hear things like, well, 3 years after the flight, or 8 years after the flight. That's the flight from Mecca to this other tribe. And that other tribe was in the city of Medina. So that's the flight from Mecca to Medina, the beginning of the Islamic calendar. Upon arriving in Medina, Muhammad built a mosque, a large mosque, purchased land and built it. And at that point, he tried to incorporate the local Jewish community into his plans because he was interested in combating polytheism. And the Jews, of course, also were against polytheism. And they cooperated to some extent. But they were no doubt troubled by the idea that God would send a prophet through Ishmael rather than through Isaac. And yet they did cooperate somewhat. Soon after his relocation, Muhammad began to raid trading caravans. Permission to do so had come through a special revelation. In the second year after the flight, Muhammad rallied the Muslim population of Medina to attack a wealthy caravan from Mecca. Well, of course, that made the people of Mecca very upset, and there's a whole sequence of battles back and forth between those in Mecca and those in Medina. Generally, it's either a draw or Muhammad gets the upper hand in the history that we're given. But in any event, Muhammad came through it. At one point, he, in fact, is in the battle, and he inflicts a mortal wound himself on one of those who was attacking them. And for the next several years, Muhammad continued to lead these raids. He also continued to marry local widows. He also increased his persecution of the Jews. As I mentioned, he began trying to cooperate with the Jews, but that began to become persecution, and that persecution increased. He eventually forced all of the Jews to leave Medina. His revelations also continued. And curiously, his revelations always came at just the right time to give him permission to do what he wanted to do. Let me give you one example of that. At one point, Muhammad became romantically interested in the wife of his adopted son. The adopted son was perfectly willing to hand his wife over to Muhammad, but three things stood in the way. One, there was in Islam an idea that divorce was evil, and so the son would have had to have divorced the wife for Muhammad to have married her. Two, there was a limit in the Quran of four wives per man, and he was up to four, so this would have been number five. And the third problem was that there was a social principle at the time that no distinction should be made between adopted sons and sons by birth. And in the Quran, there was something that said you should not marry the wife of your son, your natural son, and that, of course, then they applied to the adopted son. So there were three big things in the way of Muhammad marrying the wife of his adopted son. What to do? Well, let's have a revelation. Muhammad soon received a special revelation informing him that the woman in question had, past tense, been given to him in marriage. Because the revelation spoke of it in past tense, there was no formal marriage that had to be held at all. The woman just went to live with Muhammad. She was now his wife, according to this special revelation. And in fact, the same revelation allowed Muhammad to exceed the four wife per man limit. Just Muhammad. It applied only to the prophet. Everyone else still at four. Special revelation said, you, Muhammad, can go beyond four, which he then did. We need to stop at this point for three important points. Number one, one of the surest signs of a man-made religion is a special revelation from God for its leader or leaders to engage in sexual immorality. One of the surest signs of a man-made religion. We saw that with Mormonism. We see that right here with the Islam and Muslim beliefs. One of the surest signs of a man-made religion. Number two, point number two. Islam includes a doctrine known as abrogation, in which pronouncements of the prophet abrogate or declare null and void his earlier pronouncements. So they have to order the things that he said somehow. And there's a whole science behind this in Islam, where they put things in the proper order so they can know, well, this cancels that and this cancels this. It would be as if in the Sermon on the Mount, we had to start at the end and read backwards, because things Jesus had said at the end would cancel and declare null and void the things he said at the beginning. That's the way the Muslim faith works. That's the way the Quran is read. And the third point I want to stop and make here is that with this background, it should not surprise us if the Quran is a confused and confusing mess. And it is. Muhammad rambles along throughout, combining and misstating numerous events from the Old Testament and other sources. The Quran repeats the story of the Exodus 27 times in the first 89 chapters, and yet never mentions the Passover, presumably because of the connection with Christ. He refers to Noah in 28 of the first 71 chapters. One scholar wrote that if the repeated portions of the Quran were removed, it would be only 40% of its current length. And he very often gets the details wrong. In one account of the Exodus, Pharaoh asked Haman, the Persian from the book of Esther, Pharaoh asked Haman to build the Tower of Babel. Now, these errors, I think, help explain some of the rising antagonism toward the Jews. The Jews, no doubt, laughed in his face when he said this sort of thing. They knew exactly what had happened. They were familiar with the Old Testament, and they would no doubt cast well-deserved doubt on his role as a prophet, his status as a prophet. I think that led to some of the rising antagonism and persecution of the Jews by the Muslims. Let's continue with our history. Soon the religion of Islam became dominant in Arabia. Several factors contributed to that. One, of course, was his considerable military strength. He had a lot of people, and they were armed. The second, of course, had to do with this idea of paradise that he promoted. We talked some about that last time. He repeatedly redefined heaven as a giant God-owned bordello in the sky, and that attracted a number of followers. In the eighth year after the flight, the eighth year of their calendar, Muhammad and his forces re-entered that city of Mecca. He had been thrust out of Mecca and had to escape for his life. 8 years later, he's riding back into the city with his armed forces. And Muhammad rides his camel up to the center of that city and touches the great black stone with his staff and says, "Ali Akbar, Ali Akbar." And we all know from the news what that means. Allah is great. During the last 10 years of his life, Muhammad personally led 27 military campaigns. And he planned and sent others on 38 other military campaigns. During the final years, he claimed to have received revelations denying the divinity of Christ. And he claimed to have received a revelation that another prophet would reign for 7 years at the end of time. One of the signs, he said, that would be promoting that, or would show us that that final prophet was about to come, was that buildings would be built higher and higher and higher, which may explain some of the terrorist preoccupation with tall buildings. Some speculate. Muhammad became ill and died in 632, the age of 63, leaving behind 9 widows. And as he wished, he was buried where he died. And that site is now at the center of the Mosque of the Prophet in the city of Medina. 2 world powers existed during the life of Muhammad and the spread of Islam. The Byzantine or East Roman Empire, which represented the Christianity of that day, and the Persian Empire, which practiced Zoroastrianism. Islam stripped the former empire, the Byzantine Empire, of its holdings in Asia and Africa, greatly reduced it in size, and it completely destroyed the Persian Empire, completely destroyed that. Within 6 years of Muhammad's death, all of Syria and Iraq were tributary to Medina, and after 4 more years, Egypt was also added to the growing Muslim empire. That's the life of Muhammad. Let's look at some questions about Muhammad and Islam. Number 1, do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? The answer is no, they do not. Muslims worship a false God, Christians worship the one true God. Now, when I say that, I have to take note that I am disagreeing with our commander-in-chief, because George Bush has said on numerous occasions that Muslims and Christians pray to the same God and worship the same God. But he is wrong. John tells us that in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And he tells us the Word is Christ who came, became flesh, and dwelt among us. Muslims deny the divinity of Jesus Christ. They deny that he is God. 1 John 2:23 tells us that we cannot have the Father without the Son. You cannot peel off the Father and without the Son and then have the Father as some God apart. No. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Ishmael, our God, is the Trinity, that we, the Godhead, God the Father, God the Son, the Holy Spirit. You cannot start peeling one off and saying, this is the God I worship. Allah is a false God, and Allah is most definitely not great. And Allah was not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Allah was not the God of Ishmael. The second question, what are these so-called satanic verses? Satanic verses is an expression created by a historian, Sir William Muir, in reference to several verses allegedly received by Muhammad and later retracted. And again, keep in mind, all that we know about this event comes from Muslim sources. There are numerous reports on the incident and these biographies and things that we talked about earlier. And they can broadly be put together to produce the following account. In its basic form, the event is that Muhammad longed to convert the people of Mecca to Islam. And yet they worshiped these false gods as he saw them. They were false gods, in fact, and they were polytheistic. And as Muhammad was reciting part of the Quran, considered a revelation by Gabriel, the story is that Satan tempted him to utter the following lines after two of the verses that he had been reciting. And the line was, "Have you thought of Alat, Al-Uzza, and Manat the third, the other?" Well, what in the world does that mean? Allah, Allah, Uzza, and Manat were three goddesses worshipped by those people in Mecca. And the idea here is that Muhammad apparently was backing away from his uncompromising monotheism and telling these people in Mecca that, well, hey, these goddesses are real and you might try getting intercession from them. Have you thought of asking these three goddesses for help? The Meccans, of course, were overjoyed that now Muhammad was embracing their gods. And so, in fact, according to the event, they started coming back. They'd been persecuted. They started returning home. Islamic tradition tells us Gabriel chastised Muhammad for adulterating the revelation, and at which point he gave him a new message. And Muhammad retracted those two verses he'd added. Those verses are called the satanic verses. And he then retracted them and said, no, 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 that's not what I should have said at all. And then it went back to the way it had been before. Now, Salman Rushdie, we recall the name, wrote a novel called The Satanic Verses. It had a death warrant put out for him. And that novel was based on that very event in the life of Muhammad, which comes to us from Islamic sources. Nevertheless, most Muslims today reject that account and say that never happened. That's a false account of his life. What they don't explain is why the same sources are to be trusted on other matters. They're looking at the same sources and saying, we don't accept this, but we do accept all this other stuff. It's coming from the same sources. They offer no explanation for why they can pick and choose the things about Muhammad that they like. Question number three, is Muhammad mentioned in the Bible? Well, the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes in several broad senses. It's yes in that the Bible has much to say about false prophets, and Muhammad was certainly a false prophet. But I think we can be even a little more specific than that. Three of the world's major religions claim Abraham as their father, in some sense. Abraham came from Ur, which was part of the Chaldean Empire, part of modern-day Iraq. Genesis 15, God told Abraham his descendants would be as numerous as the stars in heaven. And yet, as we know, the years passed and Abraham had not had a child, not had an heir. Seemingly worried about the prophecy, he goes to Hagar at Sarah's urging and has a son named Ishmael. 14 years later, of course, Sarah gives birth to Isaac. Now, the history of the world in many ways has been shaped by the struggle between those two brothers, Ishmael and Isaac. One the child of promise, the other not the child of promise. Modern day Arabs trace their history back to Ishmael. Jews, of course, trace their ancestry back to Isaac. Even before Ishmael was born, God told Hagar the type of man he would be. Genesis 16, verse 12. He will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. He shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. A wild man, every man against him, he against every man, dwelling with his brethren. I think perhaps we can see that trait continuing in the descendants of Ishmael. Abraham later pleaded with God that Ishmael would not be forgotten. Abraham loved Ishmael, did not want him to be forgotten. And God at that point told us more about Ishmael. Genesis 17, verse 20. And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him, will make him fruitful, will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. That's speaking of Ishmael. That's speaking of the Arab nation, the descendants of Ishmael. And that's also mentioned in Genesis 21, verse 13, again. Now, although Isaac was the child of promise, Ishmael was also a part of God's plan. We see that here as God is saying, I will also make of him a great nation. In fact, in Genesis 21, God saves Ishmael's life when he was near death, when he and his mother were cast out by Sarah, at Sarah's urging, and with God's permission was cast out. In verse 20, the Bible tells us God was with the lad, speaking of Ishmael. I think we can learn at least two things from these important events in the book of Genesis. One, God knew what type of man Ishmael would be, and yet God spared his life and God was with him. In fact, he promised to make a great nation out of him, and of course he did. We see that nation today, just as we see the physical nation that God made from his brother Isaac. Second thing I think we can learn from this is that politicians and media pundits today can do all they want to anchor this current conflict and things that have happened in this century or in the last century. But the truth is that this family feud goes back 4,000 years. Virtually every Old Testament prophet had something to say about it. And history tells us it has continued almost unabated up until the present day. But you say, you know, surely no Middle East person today is fighting because of things that happened thousands of years ago. They've got to be fighting over new things, right? They can't still be upset about something that happened thousands of years ago. Well, let me just let you listen to what they say. Here's something Yasser Arafat said. Be assured that the many indignities heaped upon the Palestinian people since ancient times must and shall be avenged. Israel's policy in the occupied territories is little more than an extension of the important tactics of the conqueror, Joshua. Ishmael shall have his revenge, close quote. Not upset over things that happened thousands of years ago? How about one more by Anwar Sadat? Quote, the assassination of Arab brethren like Goliath by Jewish sheep herders like David is the sort of shameful ignominy that we must yet set aright in the domain of the occupied. They're still fighting about Goliath. Yeah, they're still upset over things that happened thousands of years ago. While the Bible generally discusses false prophets, and more specifically discusses Ishmael and his descendants, it is not true that Muhammad is specifically and directly mentioned in the Bible, although Muslims claim that it is. And they point in at least two places for that. They point to Isaiah 29:12, for example, which reads, and the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I am not learned. Muslims say the book is the Quran. The not learned person, the illiterate person, in fact, is what the word really means, they say is Muhammad. And of course, they say the person delivering that book is Gabriel. They say that's a prophecy of the Quran showing up. But of course, this verse from Isaiah has nothing, nothing at all to say about any descendant of Ishmael in AD 600, but is rather directed to the descendants of Isaac in 700 B.C. The point being made here is that God's people were refusing to pay attention to him. So you have several instances where a book is delivered to someone and they refuse to read it. First, it's a literate person. Then it's an illiterate person. No one wants to read the word of God is the point that Isaiah is making here. Has nothing, nothing at all to say about Muhammad in the Quran. A second verse that the Muslims point to is Deuteronomy 18, verse 18. We're all familiar with that one. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee, and will put my words in his mouth. He shall speak unto them as I shall command him. They point to that verse and say, aha, that's Muhammad. But of course, that's not Muhammad at all. That's Jesus, as Peter makes very clear in Acts 3:22, where he quotes the same verse and tells us that's a prophecy of Christ. And there are some other verses they also point to, claiming Muhammad is mentioned. He is not mentioned anywhere in Scripture, directly and specifically. In our closing moments, let's talk about some of the contrast with Christ. Of course, the biggest contrast of all is that Jesus is God and Muhammad is a man. We've already mentioned that one. Let's look at two others. The cross. It's interesting that while Muslims accept that Jesus was sent by God, they don't deny that Jesus lived or that he was sent by God. They do deny that he is God. They just say he's another prophet. But while they accept that Jesus was sent by God, they deny that he was crucified. One Sunni Muslim writes that Muslims believe that Allah saved the Messiah from the shame of the cross. Another Muslim writes that Muslims honor Jesus more than Christians do because Muslims refuse to believe that God would permit Jesus to suffer death on the cross. In short, Islam has no understanding of the cross, no understanding of its central nature to the gospel. Why? They have no understanding of that. So as we look at these contrasts with Christ, I want us also to be thinking about how we could approach someone we know in the Muslim faith to convert them to the truth, to the gospel. This is one thing they would have to be brought to an understanding of, and that's the cross and what it means, because they don't understand that. You know, we can see some of this contrast with how Muslims look at mockery of themselves and of their prophet. You know, when Muhammad was recently portrayed in 12 cartoons in a Danish newspaper, the uproar, the global uproar of Muslims, it continues to this day from those 12 cartoons, which if you saw them, you knew they were just innocuous. They were hardly cartoons. I mean, there was really nothing to them. And yet, just the thought of that produced such an uproar in the Muslim world. Christians, by contrast, were told to expect mockery. Christ was called names. He was mocked while on this earth. He told his disciples to expect the same treatment. Psalm 22:7, Isaiah 53:3, Matthew 10:25. Those who follow Christ are mocked today. And Christ is mocked today. One so-called artist recently portrayed Christ in a manner that is so disgusting and disrespectful that I will not describe it here today. But instead, I will only say regrettably that we paid for it because it was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. Christians certainly were angered by that. We were shocked by that, but we did not seek to murder the artist. In fact, we should have prayed for that artist. We know that as Christians, we must suffer with Christ outside the gate, bearing his reproach. Hebrews 13, 12 through 13. 1 Corinthians 1, 18. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. And if we're going to reach a Muslim with Christ, we have to reach them with the truth of that verse. It is the power of God. While Muhammad was very swift to shed the blood of others, Jesus Christ shed his own blood for us. Second huge contrast is the resurrection. Muhammad is in his tomb to this day. Jesus Christ is not. One tomb is empty, the other is not. What a contrast. But you know, that will not always be the case, that one tomb is empty and the other is not. Because the day will come when Muhammad will come out of that tomb at the command of Christ. And Muhammad will bend his knee and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. At that time, Muhammad will answer for his false prophecies, will answer for his thievery, will answer for his sexual perversions, and the billions who have followed him will answer as well. Our goal as Christians must be to turn as many from that path as we can, as many as we can. The only way to do that is to proclaim and preach to them the gospel of Jesus Christ. When they understand the cross, when they understand that the cross is not something to run from, not something to deny, but the cross is the power of God, to salvation. When they understand that, and they understand that Jesus Christ is God, and that he was raised from the dead, and that he presently rules from heaven, when they understand these things, only then can they then look at their own false prophet Muhammad and see that they have been led astray. And we should pray that that day will come, that in fact they will turn to the truth, because Muhammad, his forces are spreading. Islam is growing, and it can be fought only with the truth of the gospel. And that is our weapon. Not weapons of carnal warfare, Paul tells us, but the gospel of Jesus Christ, the sword of the Spirit. And that is how we have to fight this battle. And it is a battle, and we must be involved, and we must fight it, but with the sword of truth in our hand. I thank you very, very much for your attention today and throughout both of these quarters as we've studied these thought-provoking questions. Please remember all of this material, including the audio of each lesson that you could put on an iPod or play on your computer, or is all available on the internet and will remain available in the future if you have questions and want to come back and look at any of this material again. Thank you again very much for your attention.